मनोबुद्ध्यहङ्कारचेतानि नाहम् न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मेय चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा। शिवोहं 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 शिवोहं
Hello and greetings and namaste and bonjour and bonsoir and buenas noches and buonasera, and those are the languages that are coming to mind at the moment. It's really wonderful to be here with you in sacred space again, and I notice that as this hour grows closer, everything about the mundane seems to fall away, and I think that's really a beautiful tribute to the Sangam, is that as our attention, as our intention comes together to enter into this practice together, that the vortex begins to gather us in, and now here we are. We're still riding the wave of Guru Purnima, at least that's what I'm noticing myself, and the light of the Capricorn full moon, which is the full moon that always occurs during this particular holiday. It's always a Capricorn moon. Capricorn, as you know, is not the easiest energy. I say this as someone who has a Capricorn sun. It's an energy that actually demands work from us. It demands a kind of striving. And I always notice this in Guru Purnima. It's not a particularly easeful holiday, at least not for me. And it certainly wasn't this year, partly because we were having an eclipse. But what I also find, and maybe many of you did as well, is that it activates energies that seem to redirect us into a deeper commitment to practice. And in India, right now, and in other places in that particular region of the world, it's monsoon season. And in the old days, probably not so much anymore, it was a time of really radical inwardness when sadhus stopped wandering and found shelter to do intense practice. So these days, conditions are different, and in many places, the traditional ways of sadhus are not quite as they were, but it still goes on, and the quality of Guru Purnima is still one of heightened attention to practice. Even, you know, for those of us who are in the northern hemisphere in the height of summer, here in California, where the sun is shining very brightly. So the thing about monsoon in the tradition is that because it's very, very wet, because it rains pretty much every day, and the earth gets soft, it comes at the end of hot season, when it's not just incredibly hot, but incredibly dry. And, you know, what happens when the rainy season starts, happens in California here at a different time of year, is that the earth begins to green, and plants and flowers start to spring out of the earth. And the lore of monsoon is, and it's certainly been my experience when I've been in India during monsoon, is that the heart also grows moist. So qualities begin to spring forth in us that are conducive to sadhana. And what this means is that as the heart is moistened, the buddhi is also moistened. In other words, as devotion and commitment and intention begin to arise in the heart, they also affect the mind. And, you know, we were talking last week about one of the main teachings of classical yoga, which is the teaching that buddhi is the arena of transformation, that it's buddhi, you know, that clear field of awareness, which is usually translated into English as intellect, but that's not really what buddhi means. Buddhi means really the awakened part of our consciousness, the clarity of our consciousness. And remember, we get covered by the webs of avidya, of ignorance, and that ignorance is actually what covers the buddhi. And meditation, which gradually takes us past the clutter of samskaras, which literally cleans the buddhi in the process of meditation, allowing thinking, the thinking mind, to start to dissolve into the uncluttered field of awareness, is both the method but also the field of transformation. And the contemplative practices that we've been doing, and the practices of asking questions of yourself and letting intuitive answers arise, they help jumpstart the process and they take it forward. And then the so-called ethical practices, which we're going to work with during class today and next week, and that I'm going to ask you to work with in your practice in the week to come, are what actually let us test our practice in daily life and also carry it forward. Because the truth is, I mean, the reason that I think so many of us are loving the Yoga Sutras is that it's such a full court press assault on ignorance. And the tactics that we're about to see as we enter the section on the eight limbs are really the heart of the process. So let's find ourselves a posture and remember that our Sangham is seated together in this virtual realm where we are gathered around the deep blue lake, the bottomless lake of consciousness, high in the Himalayan mountain range, the lake called Manasarovar, which means really the lake of the mind, the lake of the purified mind. The Great Lake is not only a place of beauty and transformation, it's also a representation of what we are at our essence. And as you sit here, as you take your seat, feel yourself grounding, feel your sits bones, your buttocks, really taking the support of the earth, recognizing that you are seated in a very sacred place. In fact, the place where you're sitting, whether it's in your home or your office or the seat of your car, is a sacred place. And as you close your eyes and feel the breath sweeping through your body, which is what I'm going to ask you to do right now, feel the breath sweeping through your body from the toes up through the legs, up through the pelvis, through the lower abdomen, up through the chest, the neck, the head, and then sweeping with the exhalation back down to the feet. So you're inhaling upward from the feet through the crown and downward from the crown down to the feet, feeling that you're breathing the gift of earth energy up through your body, and then with the exhalation, drawing heaven energy down through your body to the earth. Feel that as the breath flows in and flows out, we're going to chant the mantras. And as we chant, or as we prepare to chant, inhale with the feeling that the breath is flowing in into the heart and actually opening you to the recognition of the heart lotus in the center of the chest, so that the chants come out of the heart and are offered back into the heart. So we'll begin with Om, and we'll chant the mantras to the Guru, the Eternal Guru. The mantras, the invocation to the primordial goddess, and then the traditional Patanjali invocation mantras. You can bring your hands into Anjali Mudra or place your right hand over your heart, over your heart center in the center of the chest, your left hand on top of it. Big inhalation together. Om. Shivaya Gurave Satchitananda Murataye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Vande Gurunam Charanaravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhavabodhe Nishreyase Jangalikayamane Samsarahala Halamohashantye Abahu Purushakaram Shankachakrasidharinam Sahasrashirasam Shvetam Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim. With your awareness in the heart, with your feeling of the heart in the heart, feel that the heart space now extends outward to the front of your body, about two hands distance in front of you to each side in the back, so that you're sitting inside this sphere of the heart, which is much greater, much bigger than your physical body, and whose edges actually can dissolve into the great consciousness and the great heart. And feel that in the center of the extended heart space is a lotus whose petals are made of light. And in the center of the lotus, find the heart flame, the flame of the self. And let the breath, as it flows in, touch the flame so that you become more and more centered in awareness of the light at the center of your heart. And as you exhale, feel it expanding all around you. In your hands, find the flame. The flame in your heart taking shape as the flame that you're holding in the palms of your hands. And feel yourself extending your hands, offering the flame into the lake, and noticing how the flames of every one of us now float and dance around the lake. And gathering our intentions for this evening, we ask that our practice be of benefit to all beings, that it bring healing to all those who need healing, that it bring expansion and light to all those who are in darkness, that all beings be free of suffering, both external suffering and inner suffering, that we know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering, that we be free of attachment, of envy, of grasping, of hatred, of dullness, and that we know our connection to all that is. And in that space of offering, be aware that your intention, the intention that we've just spoken, is the intention of the great source of all, whose compassionate intention it is for us to know ourselves in this utterly exalted and connected way. And so as you sit and as you inhale, feel that the inhalation draws in the grace and tender affection, the compassionate glance, the compassionate wish, the compassionate presence of that great force that is the source of all of us and who is present with us in every moment. And just allow yourself to breathe in that compassionate light and to breathe out any nervousness, any tension, any fear. In this practice, we're drawing in light and love, and we're offering everything that separates us back into that light, understanding that this is what Ishwara wants us to do, to really offer everything that separates us from our essential being, which is the being of the great heart itself, and allow it to be held and dissolved. Some of you who are, excuse me for plunging right into speaking, but those of you who are still in meditation, now please, you have my full permission to hold onto the state of being in this relationship of breathing in divinity and breathing your smallness back into divinity, allowing yourself to be, to really surrender your smallness to Ishwara, which is one of the meanings of Ishwara Pranidhan. So what I started to say is that if you, as some of you I know are comparing the different translations and commentaries on the Yoga Sutras, of which there are many, you may notice that there are differences in some of the interpretations, and that the particular commentarial work that we are working with, particularly Pandit Rajamani's commentaries on the first two books, differs from the standard commentaries because it talks about Shakti. And, of course, the reason for this, as I've been saying throughout the class and as I think you've been discovering, is that this commentary comes from a tantric tradition, specifically a Shakta tantric tradition. You know, one of the characteristics of the tantric traditions, and particularly of those parts of the tradition that emphasize the workings of the divine feminine power, the Shakti, is that there's an overall understanding that there is no part of life that is not sacred. And so when we begin to speak about ignorance and its effect on our lives and the path through ignorance, the path out of ignorance, from a tantric point of view, what we also look at is the ways in which ignorance occludes the experience of our powers, our own natural skills, and the ways in which our practice, our meditation, and as we'll see, our practice of the yamas and niyamas, the so-called ethical practices, they are ethical practices, but they're much more, how our practice not only opens us to that which is beyond the individuality, beyond our individuality, but also opens us to the full expression of the unique Shaktis that are the way we are meant to function as individuals in the world. I want to spend just a few minutes before we get into the yamas and niyamas discussing some aspects of Pandit Rajamani's commentary on Sutra 24, in which he discusses what happens to our Shaktis when buddhi is occluded by ignorance, and that we're not going to get into that in great detail today. What I find interesting about it, and what I think you will find interesting about it, is that what the text is describing here, and the text that this teaching comes from, is a Sankhya Yoga work called the Sankhya Karikas, which is one of the famous books of Sankhya philosophy. And what it describes is basic spiritual materialism and the effects of spiritual materialism, what I might call deluded spirituality, including deluded religious practice. And I think it's a very interesting to look at it and to discuss it a little bit, because it's so utterly recognizable. You know, in tantric understanding, ignorance is both avidya, is both the cause and the effect of what in Sanskrit is called shakti daridriya, which literally means poverty of shakti. In one of my favorite tantric texts, the Spandakarikas, there is a phrase which says, depression is the result of poverty of shakti. So everything that brings us down, everything that makes us feel stuck and limited, is actually the result of the fact that our innate powers have become contracted. So when our awareness is clouded by ignorance, we are essentially cut off from our relationship with the inner guru, Ishwara, and identifying ourselves as a personal limited mind. And in that gesture, in that moment, and in the subsequent lives that we live from that space, we forget that we have full access to divine power and to the Shaktis that are a natural part of it. So we tend to kind of resist fully giving up to our higher mind. And I don't know if you recognize this, I certainly do, that there's, you know, that one of the innate resistances that often comes up when we're in meditation, when the world open, when the inner world starts to open up to us, is that there's a kind of a feeling that if we give in, if we give up our smallness and let ourselves enter into the vastness, that we'll get swallowed up, or we'll be turned into slaves, or somehow we'll get co-opted by this great power, and it'll somehow limit our freedom. And of course, the truth is it's exactly the opposite. But because we choose over and over again to identify with our limitations, what that means is that we're forced to rely on our limited equipment. Even if we have high intelligence, strong bodies, social privileges, many opportunities, you know, in other words, we may have more access to power, and I'm using it in the biggest sense of the word, not just political power, but the power to accomplish what we want to accomplish in life. We may have more access to those powers than everyone, but nonetheless, we don't have full access. And what that means is that even our spiritual life is colored by ignorance, because when we don't realize the divine power that we have access to, we're constantly trying to get some power, some advantage from outside, from others, from books. And to find satisfaction in these gifts and qualities and achievements and accomplishments that we believe we have to wrest from a world that's other than us. And the satisfaction that we get from accomplishments, from these accomplishments which are not ever the full accomplishment that we're capable of, is called in Sanskrit tushti, T-U-S-H-T-I. It means deluded satisfaction. It's the feeling of pseudo-fulfillment that we get from mastering an aspect of the external world, or from belonging to a tribe, or from believing we know what's going on. And those satisfactions can be quite satisfying. It's just the problem is that they're not the satisfaction that we could genuinely, they're not the greatest satisfaction we're capable of. And it operates as much through our spiritual life as it does through every other aspect of life. So, for example, one aspect of deluded satisfaction is the satisfaction that we get from believing that our tradition, our religion, or our spiritual path possesses the truth about the purpose of life in the higher reality. And this particular quality of delusion is very obvious to us when we look at fundamentalist ideas, you know, like the idea that being born again in Jesus is the only path to heaven, or that Jews are the people chosen by God, or that Hindus are superior to all other beings in the world, and that every other piece of land that is not India is not a good place to be. These are all forms of deluded religious satisfaction. And of course, it's just as true in supposedly more refined spiritual cultures. You know, for instance, many Tibetan Buddhists will tell you that they're the only people who truly understand consciousness. Some Neo-Advaitins express kind of subtle feeling of superiority to people who believe that spiritual practices like mantra or even meditation are necessary, since the truth can be realized in a moment. And many tantric practitioners are absolutely convinced that Shaiva or Shakta non-dualism is the only true path, and that as long as you are remembering that everything is Shakti, you can pretty much do whatever you want. And you know, these are feelings that I think every one of us who's been in the spiritual path has experienced from time to time. It's part of our natural deluded satisfaction. You know, believing that we're going to be saved by being in the right tribe. Another aspect of this, which I find very amusing, although I of course suffer from it as much as anybody else, is that we begin to believe that if we acquire enough spiritual paraphernalia, we're on the path. You know, for instance, your japa mala, your spiritual name, the Zen simplicity of your living space, the statues on your altar, your amadal, the photos of the teacher, the special scarf that we got when we had darshan of a Rinpoche, you know, the rituals we do every day. And I say this as somebody who loves spiritual reminders, and, you know, actually I do find that an enlivened altar or statue is not only a great reminder, but can really help turn the mind inside. But they're not a substitute for our steady practice. They offer partial satisfaction only. And another, and this is where it gets kind of serious, is that we tend to believe that we have enough time. You know, that if we don't fully focus and get it right now, that we'll be able to do it tomorrow. Because, and even more than that, have you ever found yourself thinking, well, you know, as I do my practice, when the time is right, grace will fulfill me. Grace will bring it into being. Grace will make me self-realized. And we often can confuse surrender to Ishwara with a kind of passivity about doing intense practice. So, and these limited satisfactions actually make us kind of passive towards our internal practice. They make us kind of willing to settle for routine meditation. They also cut us off from using our skills in the external world. And one of the ways that Pandit Rajamani interprets these aspects of Trishti, and it's very, very Shakta Tantrika, is that they make us feel that because we're spiritual people, it's not necessary for us to develop worldly skills. So these are in a sense are some scatters of passivity and inaction. And they're quite prevalent in cultures that make a strong separation between what's spiritual and what's worldly. For instance, you know, many people in the spiritual world, and I think that includes us, believe that it's not spiritual to make money. I get these questions at conferences a lot, like, why is this conference being held in a hotel? You know, or how can teachers charge for spirituality? But it's much more insidious when it affects your own life and makes you believe that getting involved, engaged in work or family life is inevitably painful, and that therefore it's better not to try too hard. It's better not to try to make it too much better, because it's never going to work anyway. And of course it's true that life is painful. It's one of the characteristics of life. But that doesn't mean that life is not the most profound arena for your spiritual life that you'll ever find, and that knowing how to work with your work world, your family world as your path is one of the reasons you're here. So, and you know, and part of what happens when we let these forms of ignorance kind of take over is that this willingness to excuse ourselves for settling for less than is possible or for giving ourselves wholeheartedly to what we're doing means that, you know, we lose our engagement muscles, because the muscles of engagement, the muscles of finding the right balance between effort and effortlessness, between relationship and detachment, they're qualities that we actually need to use. So, and all of these come from the contractions that ignorance makes in our ability to use our shaktis. One of the gifts of practice, which I know that many of you have discovered, I know I certainly have. One of the great gifts of spiritual practice for me has been the ability it's given to me to actually not just open up to my spiritual skills, but actually to discover a deeper commitment to expressing the unique skills of my individuality, and the discovery that the two things are not in contradiction is a huge revelation that I know many of you have experienced. And part of that revelation, it's in Sutra 26, which we're not going to talk about so much today. We're going to come back to it in the final class, is the development of this quality called Viveka Kyati, which means discerning knowledge, the ability to really tell the difference between what's true and what's not true, what we need to do and what we don't need to do. And Viveka Kyati is the quality of intelligence that arises as a result of meditation practice. It's one of the skills that develops. We don't really develop it. It arises as the samskaras get melted away from the buddhi. And I know that, you know, many of us experience this state from time to time when we're having a good meditation. And another way we develop Viveka Kyati, and we're going to be doing it today and later in the week, is it's through the process of contemplation, that where you ask a question, go into meditation and allow the answers to the question to come from a deeper place than your discursive mind. So the practice of meditation combined with contemplation is going to begin to jumpstart your ability to live by your Viveka Kyati. Of course, the method that Patanjali and Vyasa, the commentator, offer us in the next part of the text is the Ashtanga Yoga, the eight limbs of yoga, which are, of course, the most familiar part of the Yoga Sutra to many of us. They're both the heart of the sutras and also the most accessible part of them. We're going to work with them during the class today, especially with the practices of the yamas, the yogic restraints, and then we're going to take them into our meditation in the days to come and actually see if we can practice them in a targeted way. So here are the sutras. Sutra 228, the practice of the limbs of yoga destroys impurities. Thereafter, true knowledge continues to shine all the way to Viveka Kyati, the domain of unshakable discernment. Sutra 229, restraint, observance, physical posture, mastery of the pranic force, recalling the senses, concentration, meditation, and spiritual absorption are the eight components of yoga. Yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi are the eight components of yoga. And finally, Sutra 230, which is the one we're going to practice with tonight, ahimsa satyasteya brahmacharya aparigraha yamaha, non-violence, truthfulness, non-stealing, continence, and non-possessiveness are the restraints, the yamas. Before we plunge into that, let's just take a moment, firm our posture. Find your awareness in the heart. Allow the breath of Ishvara, the breath of the divine, to flow in with the inhalation and with the exhalation. Allow whatever occlusion you may be finding around your buddhi to dissolve with the breath into the great field of grace that surrounds us. wanted to start by saying something about the word anga, which means limb. And the idea here is that yoga is a wholeness. It's a body. And just the way a human body normally has a certain number of arms and legs, feet and hands, the body of any form of knowledge also has components which are part of the body itself. So what that means is that you can't have yoga, really, if you're just doing asana or if you're just doing truthfulness or, in fact, if you're just doing meditation. To practice yoga in this tradition means that you are actually willing to completely engage every part of your body, mind, prana, and speech. So in this sense, this is one of the, one of the meanings of Kriya Yoga, and especially the tapas part of Kriya Yoga, because yoga is tapas in the sense that it's asking you to, as it were, rub your ordinary habits, most of which are driven by ignorance, into pieces by applying these yogic disciplines. And what you discover is that no one part of the practice can fully succeed without the others. They all kind of bleed into each other, in fact. So as you start meditating, you're going to start getting intimations of the ways in which the yamas and niyamas are crucial to, for instance, the dispersal of your karmas and samskaras and vasanas and kleshas. In the sutras, these aspects of yoga are presented sequentially, but they actually are supposed to be practiced simultaneously, because they really do enhance each other. And obviously, we practice them at the level that we're capable of practicing at any given time. We start where we are, because you can't go from never having sat for meditation to sitting for an hour, or from being completely out of shape to a fully aligned peacock pose. And you can't go from an ordinary human lifestyle of white lies, negative thinking, periodic binging on food and substances into an utterly rigorous yogic discipline. So we're going to do targeted practices, the yamas and niyamas, and I have to say I'm quite excited about it. So Dori asked a question on the listserv a couple of days ago, which was, how do we make the teachings about the kleshas, samskaras, vasanas, and vrittis actionable? What do we do, as she said, basically to get rid of them? The yamas and niyamas are, especially the yamas, they're the direct way to work with the kleshas. They utterly, directly target the kleshas. And to make that workable, I'm going to ask you all to do two things. One is to spend 5 or 10 minutes every night going over your day and notice where you were challenged in the area of one of the yamas and where you feel that you were strongly focused on the practice. In other words, check yourself out. Use this study of the yamas as a training. And the other thing I'm going to ask you to do is, for 5 days this week, devote half an hour of your meditation practice, which for some of you may be your whole meditation practice, to contemplating one of the yamas. And I'll give you instructions on how to do that in the homework, really holding it up to your life, looking at the ways you have work to do in this particular area, and also looking at practical ways that you can do the practice. So every day this week, we're going to focus on one of the yamas: Monday, nonviolence; Tuesday, truthfulness, etc. And then in the extra 2 days, you can pick your favorites. First of all, I know that all of you have a pretty strong sense of ethics. And you've also, many of you, done a lot of yoga practice. And some of these practices you've worked with for a long time, which is great. You have a head start. And as you know, with these teachings, the more we contemplate them, the deeper we can go with them. So I also want to say that again, this is important, that the yamas are not simply ethical practices, even though they are the bedrock of yoga ethics. They're actually practices for clarifying the buddhi. Now, that said, the Indian texts, both Hinduism and Buddhism, have many ethical practices. There's a lot of emphasis on ethics. In the Bhagavad Gita, for instance, Krishna mentions qualities like gentleness, forbearance, humility, unpretentiousness, forgiveness, generosity, service, steadfastness, devotion, equanimity, friendliness. And you notice that these, of course, are the qualities of a good person, the qualities of an ethical person. What Patanjali is saying here is even more radical. He's, first of all, as we said, suggesting that to do these restraints and observances is a direct result on ignorance and egotism. They don't just make your life simpler and make you a better person. They dig out the roots of your avidya, and they help you take the insights of meditation into daily life. And particularly ahimsa, nonviolence, and satya, truthfulness, directly target the essence of ignorance itself. We're going to start with nonviolence, with ahimsa, because as Vyasa says very strongly in his commentary, ahimsa is the core of all the others. It's the heart of all the others. And it connects us. Once you start examining violence and nonviolence, you see that in order to really practice it, actually requires that you are practicing the other yamas as well. And the other thing is, of course, that we live in societies, especially in the United States at this moment, in which verbal, psychological, and physical violence have become increasingly normalized and even valorized. So we're carrying with some scutters not only of our personal violent thoughts and actions, and I know that most of you here are more than relatively nonviolent. Most of us here are really do our best to be nonviolent. But we're also carrying some scars of the films we've seen, the TV news we've watched, the novels we've read, the conversations we overhear on the street or overheard on the street before we started social distancing. So ahimsa, harmfulness, is in many respects baked into society. It influences us even when we ourselves are not violent people. And what I've found as I've contemplated nonviolence is how many tendrils of casual, violent thinking towards myself and towards others are actually playing inside my psyche in any given moment and really need to be seen and, let's say, offered up or dissolved. Now, in dealing with all the yamas and niyamas, there are kind of gradations of practice. So, and it's one of the big, the issue of ahimsa is a subject of a lot of discussion, especially because in India, which is a culture that's extremely large, you know, the spiritual culture of India has practices for people at every type, of every walk of life, of every level of commitment to spirituality. So, and of course, one of the great texts of Indian spirituality is the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna urges Arjuna to fight because he's a warrior and fighting is his dharma. Even when Arjuna wants to lay down his arms and not engage in the fight, Krishna insists that he do it. And Krishna's rationale for this, or Krishna's motivation, Krishna's agenda, is that he has an intention to cleanse the world of evil people, evil kings, and Arjuna is one of his instruments for this. So the idea of righteous war, of righteous conflict, is very much baked into many aspects of the Indian scriptures, and it makes it very paradoxical, because at the same time, there is the ethic of the yogi, of the committed yogi, which is a vow of utter, complete nonviolence. You know, and in the same way, as people living in the world, we are probably going to engage in limited nonviolence because inevitably we cause harm to organisms, other organisms, just by living. Walking across a field, we step on grass. And if you've ever been in a state of oneness or taken a psychedelic, you might have had the experience that plants feel it when you step on them. You know, we brush off webs from our lampshade and we kill little spiders. And if you have a lot of empathy, you know that it hurts them. And eating a tomato means killing it, and picking a flower means killing it. And defending yourself against malaria demands killing mosquitoes. In fact, even great beings kill mosquitoes. So you wonder, there's a story about one of Ramakrishna's disciples coming into his room and saw Ramakrishna, this great saintly being, swatting mosquitoes with a rolled-up newspaper. He said, "They're eating me alive." And this was a man who could feel the grass shrieking when he walked on it. He was that sensitive. The standards of harmlessness, of ahimsa, are complex and paradoxical. But for a hardcore yogi in this tradition, there comes a point when you literally are aiming at completely giving up self, which means giving up any form of selfishness. To do the full yama practice is to directly assault your own asmita, your sense of being an individual with a self-protective instinct. Because at a certain point, you can't really be nonviolent without giving up the idea that preserving your own life is more important than anyone else's. And, you know, I would say one of the things that always deeply moved me about people like John Lewis, the civil rights leader, and other civil rights activists that I knew in my youth, they put themselves in harm's way without defending their own bodies, and they allowed themselves to be beaten and gassed and attacked by dogs for the sake of calling our attention to the injustices of Jim Crow America. And they were operating on this premise. They were operating on the premise that the sacrifice of their personal safety was worthwhile because they were serving a higher purpose. And in their case, the higher purpose was justice and equality. For a hardcore yogi, the higher purpose is merging in all that is. We're not asked, most of us, to do that level of nonviolence. However, part of what I'd like to ask us to do this week is to look at how far we're willing to go for the purposes of training for a short period of time to get a sense of what it feels like and a sense of what its effect is. Of course, nonviolence in our time includes vegetarianism. The whole movement of, you know, of taking care of the earth is essentially a movement of nonviolence. It's essentially a movement of for the yamas and niyamas. And, you know, so I know a lot of people, especially young people, Gen Z and millennial people, for whom being vegetarian or even vegan is a moral imperative and a really, really important part of their practice. And I sometimes teach with a senior yoga teacher who always shows a pita film about factory farming during her workshops. And it's a horrific film. You watch it and you come out of it never wanting to eat an animal again. I am not, by the way, a doctrinaire vegetarian, although I mostly eat plant-based food. I eat very little meat. The fact is that when you really think about the violence that is involved in killing and eating animals, especially in our time, you realize what a major violent practice it really is. And you realize that, and I don't have to tell you this, you realize that there are major consequences of, let's say, killing and eating meat or causing other people to kill and eat meat, at least to the extent that it's done in our society. And again, there are many reasons why it's sometimes necessary to eat meat, sometimes because you can't get any other food, sometimes because you actually need it for your health. I would say for most people, not eating animals is not an absolute vow, especially when we realize that eating plants also involves killing. And also when we understand that this world is made of the interactions of eating and being eaten, that, you know, that as we are eating, we are also being eaten. There's a kind of an ecosystem, a tapestry of life in which to some extent we feed on each other. So what does it really mean to practice deep nonviolence? And that's one of the things that I'd like us all to contemplate this week. You know, for instance, violence is implicit in the hierarchy of caste and race, the invisible organizations of societies in which those at the top implicitly privilege their own members. It's implied in many of the structures of social life, the financial system. It pervades the world. But what Vyasa says about the practice of nonviolence is that at its heart, it's an internal practice, one intended to dissolve the cruelty and the feeling of animosity that arises from deep-seated aversion, and which can be traced back directly to the feeling of separation that's at the heart of avidya. Because if you are really experiencing non-separation, if you really are experiencing everything as an aspect of yourself, it's going to be very hard for you to do violence to another, and certainly very hard for you to do violence to another in your heart. Gandhi said, "We may never be strong enough to be entirely nonviolent in thought, word, and deed, but we must keep nonviolence as our goal and make strong progress towards it." One aspect of violence, of course, is the isolation and separation that arises when we lose our connection to the whole. We erect walls around ourselves, first psychic ones, then physical ones, and then we defend those walls. And in order to live, we have to do this. But the difference between humans and most animals is that in general, animals, with the exception of our simian ancestors, especially chimpanzees, who act in ways that really kind of mirror some of the crueler aspects of human violence, most animals don't kill out of sheer cruelty, but for food and survival, or when they're really scared, or when their babies are threatened, or when they're cornered. It's really human beings with our powerful intelligence and imagination who subtly divide the world into us and them, friends and enemies, and live by a win-lose metrics that tells us that life is a zero-sum game where there are only winners and losers, and that the only way to be successful in life is to defend your territory at all levels. Again, we're not going to talk in detail about all the ways in which our society is violent, but when we look at ourselves, we often see that our own internal violence, even though never enacted on the outside, might take the form of judgments about ourselves and other people, of criticism that we can't get out of our minds, of self-sabotaging behaviors, you know, of extreme, intense fury at those we disagree with, which we may never express verbally, but which we often experience in ways that disrupt our peace. Vyasa uses a particular Sanskrit word in his commentary to describe this, the feeling of animosity, which is at the heart of himsa, it's called abhidroha, which means intense aversion that captures our mind from every direction. You ever have that feeling? You're just like, you just hate that person, or you look at certain political figures whose names I will not mention on TV, and you're just overwhelmed with fury. It's the internal feeling of violence that is the source of the samskaras. And of course, physical acts of violence create very bad samskaras and karmas. But internal acts of violence do the same. I have a friend who's has a hilarious and often nasty wit that's often directed at others. I mean, she's, you know, sometimes you spend, you know, or back in the day, she would just have you inside splitting laughter saying horrible things about other people. And she also has extreme environmental allergies. And about 10 years ago, she went to a healer for help with her allergies. The healer said to her, "Do you dislike a lot of people?" And my friend said, "Not really." And then she began to think about it. And she realized that she spent a lot of time ruminating over how stupid so-and-so was, how upset she was at something somebody said to her. And even with close friends, there was always a critical edge to her thinking. So she said to the healer, "So why do you ask?" And the healer said, "Well, when I look at you, I see this cloud of projected negativity around you. And I can tell you that every negative thought you have towards another person is literally debilitating you. That's what's causing your allergies. You have to stop it." And I thought that was it was an incredibly powerful moment for her. The advice the healer gave her was one that I've used myself. Every time you have a negative or critical thought towards someone, stop and send them a blessing. It's actually one of the best practices for working directly with your avidya. This story, this event, you know, which my friend took to heart, and it really changed her. It's something I've thought about a lot. And so I'd like to ask you now, I asked you to get a piece of paper and a pencil or pen or a journal. We're just going to do a moment of self-reflection on abhidroha, on animosity. So just sit for a while, take a breath, turn your awareness inside, and ask, who or what triggers animosity in you? Consider a person or a situation towards whom you feel animus. It doesn't have to be huge. Often it's a family member or a political figure. And animosity can be extremely powerful when it's accompanied by strong moral disapproval. So once you've found that person or situation that triggers animosity, see if you can feel fully into the feeling of it. Notice the state of your heart. And just let it be here for a minute. And then offer a blessing. Offer a blessing to that person or to that situation. And while you're at it, this is really important, forgive yourself we're having feelings of animosity. Say to yourself, I am an imperfect human being, and these things come up in me. And without wanting in any way to hold on to these feelings, I forgive myself for them. And I ask that in forgiving myself, I may be able to forgive that person or that situation, to let go of my critical animus towards them. And again, notice the feeling that arises. If there's anything that you'd like to write down, please do that. There's a wonderful book called The Wandering Taoist, which is about the life of a martial arts master, Chinese martial arts master. And in the second volume, the author tells a story about how he'd moved to Manhattan from China in the 1950s. He's living in the Lower East Side, which at that time was a tough neighborhood, and working in a Chinese restaurant. So whenever he went out of his apartment, he would carry his ancestral sword, which had been used by his ancestors, who were incredibly accomplished martial arts swordsmen and women. You know, and the sword was filled with their prowess, with literally generations of martial arts, targeted skillful violence. And he said that several times a week, he would be attacked on the subway or attacked on the street, and he would have to defend himself. People would come at him with knives. He would have to take out his sword and fight them off. And after several months of this, he asked around the other people he knew in the restaurant where he's working. He said, you know, do you guys get attacked a lot? And everyone said, no, I, you know, never had a problem with being attacked. And he suddenly realized that the reason he was getting attacked was because of the sword, because he was carrying this emblem of ancestral violence, and it was drawing attacks to him. So he started leaving the sword at home, and he stopped getting attacked. So right now, ask yourself, what forms of inner violence might I be carrying that are affecting the way I experience my life? That are affecting the way I experience others, that might even be drawing attack or suffering to me. And this is not about guilt tripping yourself. It's just a question. Here's another question. If you find such a thought form or such an assumption, how will you leave it behind? What will you do to leave it behind? You might actually want to consider an act that you can do, which will indicate that you've left it behind. One of the things that I often do with a quality or a trait that I'm ready to give up is I write it on a piece of paper and I light a match to it in a metal bowl and I burn it or bury it. I like burning because it dissolves it. Or you can just crumble it up and throw it in the trash. A symbolic gesture of letting it go is very, very helpful. And of course, when we're looking at our own, when we're working with our practice of ahimsa, what it will eventually turn us back to is realizing the ways we practice violence against ourselves and hold violent thoughts against ourselves. And that's part of what we're going to do this week on our own, is just begin to unpick all of that. What is the feeling state? We spend a lot of time looking at ahimsa. What is the feeling state of ahimsa? What are its qualities? And I think that most of you would recognize or even tell me if I would open the mic that true nonviolence starts with recognizing that this other person could be me. You know, just being real, willing to recognize our common humanity, to see the pain behind the person's eyes, and seeing the pain in yourself, the pain and fear that might be the cause of the qualities of irritability or impatience or self-criticism. And sometimes in opening up our genuine compassion towards another person, we can also start, you know, especially someone who is inimical to us, we can also start to see their point of view. Martin Luther King actually said, "Here is the true meaning and value of compassion in nonviolence. When it helps us to see the enemy's point of view, to hear his questions, to know his assessment of ourselves. For from his view, we may indeed see the basic weaknesses of our own condition, and if we are mature, we may learn and grow and profit from the wisdom of the brothers who are called the opposition." That is such a radical statement. You know, that realization that some of the enmity that we experience from others may have something to teach us. And very often the thing it has to teach us is about our own defensiveness, our own pride, our own intransigence in different ways. But we can't really get those lessons, including the ones that come from our own recognition of our, let's say, less than skillful qualities, until we have been willing to actually experience compassion, to not meet enmity or criticism with defensiveness. It's a very big deal. I once worked with somebody who had a very hard time accepting feedback, and I was his boss. I often had to give him feedback, but I learned that whenever I suggested he do something differently, he would get this deer in the headlights look and immediately make a joke or just pretend I hadn't said anything, and it used to drive me crazy. I actually felt unheard, so I would double down, you know, wanting to make sure that he listened to me, and he would get more and more closed. And one day I heard a tone in his voice that I recognized. And I realized that what he was doing was something that I used to do as a child when my mother scolded me. Because the scolding would trigger, you know, some kind of shame mechanism. And so I would armor myself against the feedback. And, you know, over the years I had learned to accept feedback. I considered myself pretty good at accepting feedback. But I realized that nonetheless, that, you know, that fear of criticism would very often make me put up an armor. And I saw that this attempt to hide from somebody else's negative feedback was actually at the heart of not just his defensiveness, but mine and perhaps everyone's. What I suddenly did in that moment was say to him, you know, I see this thing you do, And I want you to know it's just like me. I do exactly the same thing. So let's just open up some compassion for each other's defensiveness. And as I said that, I saw that for his walls came down and my walls came down. And for a moment, we were just essence to essence. In a certain sense, this is the birth of compassion. It's recognizing that the things you criticize in another are not only things you have in yourself, but they're also normal human traits. If you want to go back to that person who you felt animosity towards in the practice we did earlier, and imagine that person in front of you, and imagine yourself looking through their personality to the blazing essence, perhaps of the innocent child that they once were, perhaps of the soul that took this birth in order to learn some significant lessons. And ask yourself, what does this person really need from me? And notice that as you ask that question, the answer arises. And you know it's something like love. So again, allow the breath to flowing in from the heart of the divine presence. Allow it to flow into you and as you exhale, I'll give you a choice. You can breathe out compassion. Or you can breathe out the tendrils of inner violence, offering them into the compassionate heart of Ishvara. The second, and I would say equally crucial, yama is satya, or truthfulness, which we can also call non-lying. Satya, of course, doesn't just mean non-lying. It doesn't just mean truthfulness in the ordinary sense. Satya comes from the same root as being, the word for being itself, which is sat, which means that the yama of satya is the yama of standing fully in your own being with authenticity. It's very much a practice of tuning into your own being, which shines at all times. But at the same time, the practice of satya, the practice of truthfulness, really does start with looking at the ways you lie. So I would say most of us are not bald-faced liars. I mean, if you use a 1 to 10 scale with polite lies, like that dress really doesn't make you look fat at the low end, and outrageous, destructive lies like some of the ones that our president tells at the high end, and you know, actually his aren't even as bad as some. Your worst falsehoods would probably rate no more than a 3 or 4. But as you know, the lies we tell, the ways we deceive others and ourselves, actually stay lodged in our psyche. They give off smoke, and they create distrust of ourselves, you know, which even if they're not creating distrust with others, they create distrust with ourselves, which means that we are cut off every time we tell a lie from our own inner source of authenticity. So how do the, you know, how do you feel the effect of the lies you've told? It's really in the feelings of cynicism, distrust, and doubt that you feel towards yourself, and also your tendency to suspect other people of lying. And again, I'm not going to go into the ways in which truth has been trodden under the heels of politicians and media people so powerfully and destructively in our time. I do just want to recognize that absolute truthfulness demands an enormous amount of self-honesty and a lot of inquiry. The Yoga Sutras is uncompromising about satya. They say that it's an unconditional value, meaning that a yogi should never lie. I would say in our time, in the circumstances in which we live, there may be a position that strives for a kind of balance, recognizing the high value of truth, but also recognizing that truth-telling can have harmful consequences under certain circumstances, so needs to be balanced with nonviolence. You know, it's one of the great questions for finding out whether what you're about to say or think should be spoken, you know, is to ask yourself the four gatekeepers of speech, which I know many of you are familiar with. Is this true? Is it kind? Is it necessary to say? And is this the right time to say it? And they're actually a very good test to keep yourself from actually telling lies, or at least figuring out a way to be truthful without being unkind. The deepest reason for radical truthfulness is that lying and untruth, and that means dissimulation often, takes you out of alignment with reality. My guru used to say, if you can't tell the truth about something, then remain silent. So it's a kind of a form of pleading the fifth. But it's actually a very good rule of life. You know, that if you can't speak truthfully, you can at least be quiet. Because Gandhi's position, which was essentially, he did absolute truthfulness. His book, his autobiography is called My Experiments with Truth. And his insight, his position was based on the insight that truth is at the heart of reality. A Kabbalistic text calls truth the signet ring of God, and the Chandogya Upanishad says that God is truth. The fact is that any form of untruth, of disconnect between our feelings, our speech, and our actions is going to make us feel a little bit crazy. That said, obviously, there are circumstances in which it's ethically necessary to lie. And an example that I always come back to, and it's not an uncommon one, was my college philosophy teacher had been a hidden child in Germany. She was a Jewish child, and she was saved from extermination because a Catholic family took her in and then lied to the Gestapo that she was there. So clearly, that was what I would call an ethical untruth, and there are circumstances in which, you know, we make a moral choice and we decide to tell a lie. Another situation which is kind of beautiful is from the movie that you may have seen, a current movie called The Farewell, which is about a Chinese family which works out an elaborate scheme so that the family can gather around the grandmother's bedside. The grandmother's dying of cancer, but they don't want to tell her she's dying, so they pretend that they're there to celebrate a wedding. And the American-born heroine says, "Why are you doing this? You're lying to Granny. You know, it's very much not the American way to keep the news of somebody's imminent death from them." But her family says, "Because if we tell her she's dying, she'll get discouraged and it'll hasten her death. Whereas if she keeps a good mind, she may actually be able to get better." You know, so that would be a circumstance in which hiding the truth might be a good thing. You know, and yet balancing the relative value of truth and values of truth and nonviolence actually requires a lot of discernment. I would say, again, I think with all these yamas, truthfulness requires self-inquiry, a two-step process of looking into your heart. And again, we're going to do that this week, but it's very helpful. And you can ask yourself this question right now. When are you tempted to lie? Under what circumstances are you tempted to lie? And that means looking at your motives, and you can start to see, maybe you'll start to see patterns. Maybe you exaggerate to make a story better. Maybe you hear yourself saying, "I love you," to a friend or a lover when you actually are not feeling loving to them at that moment. And as you start to see the circumstances in which you tend to want to lie, then you can start to see why you lie. I have a friend who was getting divorced. She was in a custody battle, and she was asked to write up a description of different incidents where her ex-husband had been inappropriate or had failed as a father and a husband. And she wrote a series of statements about situations in which her husband had hurt her and their daughter. And when she reread the document, she realized that she'd only put in the ways that he was at fault. She had not included the ways in which she had triggered the situation or, you know, been part of the problem. And, you know, part of it was, of course, she was willing to do that in order to win. But she was also trying to justify herself. Very often when we are less than truthful, it starts with not being completely truthful with ourselves. And Patanjali's vow to unconditional truth is really much more than a commitment to factual accuracy, although that is a very good start. It asks you to become transparent to yourself, to be willing to look without bitterness, but with honesty at the parts of yourself that you're afraid to expose to scrutiny. And because satya really comes from the deepest roots of being, your real truth is going to be revealed in the moments when you're not afraid to just stand in your own being and ask yourself, "What is true for me?" Not "What is true for me that's going to be acceptable to everyone else? What is true for me on a good day?" But what is true for me? And where that takes you eventually is coming back to the pure I am. Here are some of the basics in the practice of truthfulness. Pay attention to factual truth. Try not to distort it, and when you do, call yourself on it. Notice your urge to conceal embarrassing facts, to make yourself look better, to justify mistakes, to run away from a confrontation. As much as possible, make a point of not saying anything you know to be untrue. And then begin to notice when your thoughts and your speech are in harmony and when they're not. Now, in all of these yamas and niyamas, and we'll get into this in more detail later, not later in this class, but later in the course, every one of the yamas, if you practice it powerfully, it gives you a siddhi. For instance, the siddhi of ahimsa is that other people will not be afraid in your presence, and that being with you can actually harmonize an entire situation. It's some of the power that Gandhi was able to marshal, and King as well, even though it certainly was true that not everyone loved them and both of them were assassinated. Nonetheless, the experience of being around them was an experience of open-heartedness that was very, very palpable. The power, the result of truthfulness is that your words have power. And by power, that means power to change reality. You know, in the yoga texts, there's a very deep understanding that language is an action that can change reality. But the actions that change reality in a truly powerful way, that is in the sense of making miracles or blessings, are the ones that come to a person who is really truthful. I'll give you an example. I once visited a famous Ayurvedic practitioner. I had a chronic disease at the time. And when I went to see him, I was talked to one of his students who said, so when you go to him, understand that there are two levels of healing that he does. One is formal healing, where he'll, you know, take your pulses, give you a prescription for herbs. And, you know, that's good. He's a very good physician. But the other level of healing is where he actually uses his siddhi and makes you better. In other words, he's capable of performing miracles. So here's what you have to do. Look into his eyes and silently say to him, can you heal me? So when I visited him, I did that. I didn't say anything. I just looked into his eyes and asked internally, can you heal me? And he answered, you will get better. And the amazing thing is that 3 weeks later, the symptoms of my chronic disease were gone. And it wasn't because of the herbs, because the herbs turned out to be indigestible for me. So that's the siddhi of truthfulness in action. You can give a blessing or make a prediction or state an intention, and it will come true. So take a breath for a moment. And ask for a boon. Ask Ishvara, the presence that you can breathe in. And into which your exhalation can dissolve. Ask Ishvara to give you the gift of truthfulness, to allow you to stand in truth in every moment. To allow you the discernment to speak truth with kindness, to be silent when truth can't be spoken, ask him for the blessing of never selling yourself out. Of standing in your authenticity. And standing and acting in what's true for you in Satya. And as you ask for this boon, feel that you connect. Feel that the power of truth and kindness is going to be realized. So we're going to go in a much briefer way into the last three yamas. And I'm going to ask you to contemplate them during the week. And really see if you can understand what it is for you at this time to practice it. So the third restraint is asteya, which means non-stealing. Steya means stealing. Asteya means not stealing. And I think most of us have been socialized out of outright thievery. We don't, at least not on purpose, walk off with our friend's sweater just because we like it. But, of course, what's harder is the subtler forms of stealing. And I'm going to start with one that I, as a teacher, come across all the time, which is the theft of other people's ideas, which is, you know, it's kind of a subtle thing, because of course nobody owns their ideas. Ideas come to us from the ether. They, you know, especially in spiritual life, they come as really often as downloads. But it's also true that in this world where everything is on the internet, many, many ideas are available. And, you know, many of us have the great temptation and sometimes the act of taking an idea that someone else has expressed and expressing it ourselves pretty much in their words. This happens to me all the time, by the way. I've seen at least four or five articles of mine appearing on other people's blogs under their name. I mean, it sort of blows my mind. But as I contemplated that, I realized that, you know, like all people who speak a lot in public, there have often been times when I've taken somebody else's good idea. You know, so one of the ways that we can really work with asteya is simply to give credit to other people for what we receive from them. And it actually takes quite a bit of self-discipline, I find. So there's also the deeper issue in terms of asteya, of how we use resources, because, of course, it's almost impossible. You know, just as it's very difficult to live without in some way causing, you know, being violent, it's also impossible to live without using resources that other people contributed to the world. And if you really start looking at, for instance, the way property is distributed, we realize that there are many, many forms of subtle theft and not so subtle that we benefit from, or that we consciously or unconsciously benefit from. And that just as forgiveness and compassion are the positive activities, you know, ways that we can cultivate ahimsa, the positive quality that amplifies asteya is gratitude. And there's a particular gratitude practice that I'd like to offer you now. It's adapted from a Buddhist practice, but I learned it from, I want to give credit where credit is due, I learned it from an old friend, Swami Anantananda, who some of you may know. So close your eyes and begin to consider the ways in which you depend on others. For instance, notice the fact that you're sitting on a chair and consider where the materials on your seat came from. Were they grown? Are you sitting on a cushion that's stuffed with cotton? Who grew the cotton? Who picked it? Who gathered the materials? If it's a plastic or metal chair, who smelted the metal? Who made the pattern, the mold? Who worked in the factory? Who built the factory that made the chair? Who put together the components of your computer or your phone? So many people, so many plants, so many materials from out of the earth went into the room you're sitting in now, the materials that made the building, the workers who built it. So open your inner eyes, just consider the levels of support that you receive from the world. And every time you remember one of them, just say thank you. This is a practice that we could do from moment to moment. And on a stay a day, I'm going to suggest that we really work with it in a very intense fashion. And I would say also that one of the practices for cultivating a stay a is simple acts of generosity. Giving something in charity or calling up a friend who's you maybe haven't seen in a long time and offering to do them a favor. There are a lot of ways that we can actively practice giving back to the world. And, you know, gratitude and generosity are two of the main, I call it Oprah spirituality practices. I mean, they're practices that anyone can do, that anyone can contemplate. And even though they're common and in a certain sense easy, that doesn't make them any the less transformative. I also want to talk a little bit about brahmacharya, which is one of the gnarlier and not often well understood practices of the yoga tradition. Ruth asked a question on the listserv the other day. She actually asked about the most esoteric aspect of the practice of brahmacharya, which is the conservation of sexual fluid. And I promised I would go into it. So I'm actually going to talk a little bit about the esoteric aspect of the brahmacharya practice. So the definition of brahmacharya in classical yoga is sexual continence, even celibacy, or we would translate it as sexual discipline, meaning cultivating attitudes, sexual attitudes, which are not harmful, not excessive, not exploitive, and which are undertaken with motives that include truthfulness and non-harming. And of course, the definition of brahmacharya has been broadened, and it's usually practiced in the modern world as to mean moderation in the way you use your senses in general. So that would mean moderation in eating, moderation in TV watching, moderation in all forms of sensory gratification. And again, this is a practice that every human being who's trying to be healthy, for example, learns to do. I mean, it's one of our main struggles in life is practicing sensory moderation. And it is actually very radical in our society. It usually starts, if you want to do brahmacharya in a kind of a global way, one thing you can do is to start by looking at your addictions. And when I say addictions, I don't necessarily mean, you know, the really dangerous addictions. I'm not talking about alcoholism or, you know, substance abuse. I'm talking about what we could call ordinary addictions, like TV watching or binging on chocolate or, in my case, reading is my major addiction. And you can ask yourself, okay, what am I addicted to? And then start to do some inquiry, like what's happening inside you when you're being overindulgent? Do you eat when you're nervous? Do you want to have sex when you feel lonely? When you're having a hard day, do you just want to walk into the house, turn on the TV, and escape into it? You know, are you checking your Twitter feed all the time? And it's important to realize that in a wealthy society, when we're absolutely bombarded with sensory stimulation, it's very hard not to become addicted to it. The discipline of brahmacharya is not about total renunciation, because many of the things that we become addicted to can't be renounced, like food, for example. So I'm a strong believer in disciplined indulgence. I think that it's really the most sustainable form of brahmacharya, realizing that certain sensory pleasures enhance the goodness of your life, and learning how to do them in such a way that they're pleasurable but don't damage your health or distract you from your practice. I have a friend who's a reading addict, and I learned this from him. He works with it by giving himself timed intervals in which he gets to read, and he turns off his Kindle. He sets the alarm, turns off his Kindle after half an hour or an hour. And I also want to pass on to you a trick I learned from one of my teachers about eating sweets, because it completely changed my relationship to my own sweet tooth. She told one of her students who was dieting and, you know, didn't want to just turn her life into a desert of austerity. She said, take a square of chocolate, cut it into four pieces, and have one after lunch, one after dinner, and the other two as a snack. And that way you'll get a sweet taste, but you won't overdo it. I find that's actually really, really helpful. And we can also do the same thing with our sexuality. It's a major yogic principle that we leak energy through uncontrolled use of the senses and mind. So there is a huge significance in discerning, in conserving our energy. And that means conserving our energy physically in the way we use our mind and in the way we use our senses. And this is a topic that you're going to explore this week, and you're going to look at how your senses, for example, one of my favorite ways to let my senses go crazy is walking down a shopping street in a big city. And what I always notice is that, you know, I'm drawn by every shop window. I get completely into it. And then when I'm done, I'm utterly exhausted. So, and this is what happens to us when we train the senses on objects that tend to bring up our addiction, our addictive nature. And that said, you know, sometimes we just need to binge on something. And that's okay, especially when it's done inside a fundamentally disciplined lifestyle. When you're disciplined in eating in general, you can afford to blow out and eat a pizza sometimes because, you know, your system is able to do it. I want to answer Ruth's question about sexual energy and sexual fluid. The siddhis associated with the yamas and niyamas are huge clues as to why they're yogically important. And the siddhi that's associated with brahmacharya is the attainment of virya, which means spiritual power. And it's based on the idea that your sexual energy is actually the substance which carries your spirit upwards. So by conserving sexual energy, you actually have it available for deep meditation practice. Now, in the tantric traditions, and also in some of the classical yogic traditions, there's a lot of emphasis on awakening kundalini and carrying kundalini upward. And the secret of kundalini, at least when it's being awakened in the yogic fashion, is that kundalini uses the same energy source that sexuality does. So the idea of conserving your sexual energy in the classical yogic tradition and in many of the tantric traditions is for the sake of making that energy available to fuel the awakening and the rise of kundalini. We actually, if you're going to have an extremely powerful and deep meditation practice, it's actually very helpful to be sexually continent, certainly during the period of deep meditation like on a retreat. The other gift that brahmacharya offers to yogis and especially to spiritual teachers is that energy can be used to fuel the transmission of wisdom and shakti to students. And Pandit Rajmani actually refers to the process of Shaktipat, which is something that was done a lot in my tradition. And, you know, it's said in the yogic tradition that the power to transmit spiritual energy, awakening energy to a student is the result of the accumulation of your sexual fluid. I would say that that's partially true. There are a lot of transmissions that actually come through a lineage, come directly through from the divine into a student. And a teacher can be a channel for that without actually tapping their own virya. But it's also true that there are certain kinds of energetic transmission which are very dramatic, which involve an instantaneous awakening of kundalini, and which can be practiced, can be done, can be given by a very accomplished teacher who has the full presence of the virya that is accumulated through sexual continence. Now, one more thing. Ruth asked the question about male sexual fluid, which is how virya is usually described in the texts. So the technicalities of sexual fluid are one of the mysteries of the yogic tradition, because these traditions were essentially, especially classical yoga, were traditions that were kind of built for male practitioners. There were not that many female practitioners in the classical yoga world. So when they talked about virya, they actually associated it with semen. And, you know, a lot of the yogic work on brahmacharya is about retaining the semen. The female sexual fluid is not as obvious. So in yogic circles, it's often confused with menstrual blood, which is also highly visible, and which certainly has a connection to the life force, as semen does, but is a different substance than feminine sexual fluid, and is, you know, is something that I know modern-day yoginis actually are exploring. But however you define vidya, whether you define it as an actual physical substance or whether you define it more subtly, which is what I tend to do, as the feeling of sexual energy that can begin to arise in your lower chakras during certain practices, being willing to work with your own sexual energy by using it to draw kundalini up into the central channel is a very powerful practice that has a profound effect on your inner state. Because when we're able to take sexual energy to focus it and draw it into the body itself, up into the belly and up into the heart, then we'll often experience the quality of internal blissfulness, which can be so exquisite that we experience a pleasure that is more subtle but also more pleasurable than, for most of us, than physical pleasure. So the practice of brahmacharya is really the practice of working with your own energies such that they become refined and balanced. And this happens by working with the mind and the prana, the mind and the breath, to actually merge clarity of mind, clarity of breath with the different energies in your body and begin to allow them to expand your center, to open up your inner body, to allow you to slip the boundaries of physicality and recognize your oneness. All of this is powered by the inner spiritual energy, kundalini. And part of the way we cultivate that power is by being very conscious of how we're using our energies. So we're going to end here because that's the end of our time. And you're going to be getting this in the homework assignment, taking a day to practice, fully practice ahimsa. That's your practice for the day. A day to practice truthfulness. A day to practice non-stealing. Brahmacharya and aparigraha, which is non-grasping, which I'm going to leave to you to contemplate. I'll send you some lore about it in the homework. And to realize that as we practice these, even a little bit, our minds and bodies are transformed by the practice. And we begin to live what's sometimes called uncommon lives. Lives in which our characters become refined and our minds become clear and the kleshas begin to be eroded from our being, because every moment that you look into your own kleshas and decide that in that moment you'll practice one of the yamas or niyamas for the sake of dissolving that klesha, your consciousness expands. And little by little, that expansion begins to take over your life. So full court press yoga. And we're going to make a final plunge into meditation, just for a few minutes, because I know that we're out of time. But find your posture. Ground through the sits bones and hips and thighs. Let the torso rise from that grounded base. Allow the head to float to the ceiling. Bring your attention into the heart lotus. Those of you who are more comfortable practicing with the center in the head, the Ajna Chakra, you're very free to take that as your locus of awareness. And just take a moment and find into which part of your inner body does your attention want to come. Let it be natural. And now become aware that you're completely surrounded by the presence of grace, by the presence of love, by the subtle pulsating presence of that being whom the Yoga Sutra calls Ishvara. Which the Shakta traditions call goddess. Which the Taoists call the Tao. Which is filled with vastness and power and incredible love. And feel that this love, this vastness, this power is regarding you with infinite affection, offering itself for you to join with. And so as you breathe in, you take in the grace and love of this compassionate presence. And as you exhale, you offer your smallness, your defensiveness, your self-doubt, very gently with the exhalation into that presence, feeling that at this moment, you're willing to open fully to the beauty and the love and the power that is what you are. Every breath draws in the grace of the great self. Every exhalation breathes out the contractions, the feeling of separation, the fear, the tiredness, the boredom, the hiding. Breathes it out and allows it to be transmuted into that love which flows into you. A beautiful week. We are going to do a Q&A this Friday morning at 10 a.m. You'll get a note about it in your homework. And you'll also receive the link to it. It's going to be on the same audio channel. And it will be recorded, so you'll be able to listen to it later if you can't be there in person. And it would be great if you could think up some questions. Ask them in person, or if you can't be there in person, send them to Deb. Have a beautiful evening, and we'll close with the Nirvana Ashtakam, the great awareness that we are that great I Am who holds and loves and embraces us at every moment.
मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचेतानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमिन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातुर्न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप Shivoham, 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 Shivoham.